Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Be Unique Unscripted, because an authentic life is unscripted. Presented by Bronner House Museum, Elisa Kaler, the spiritual therapist, and Little Green Oasis. Unscripted brings you amazing guests and open mic nights every Thursday night at 9 o'clock Eastern Time. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an opportunity to learn more. Visit our calendar on beunique.org to see who we have scheduled to appear next. That's beunique.org.
Hello, hello, hello. This is your host, Mary Brotherton, and I am here with a man who has more names than most people have hats, and he wears hats, too. David Languedoc. Ooh, I didn't even check before the show. Did I pronounce that right, David? Hello?
Hello.
David, hello. I forgot to ask before the show how to pronounce your last name.
It is pronounced Longo.
Longo. I totally got that one wrong.
Yeah, everybody does. Don't worry about that. And even we've got it wrong. That's a Canadian. If we were in France, it would be Languedoc.
Ah. Well, so, I'm just going to jump right in here and say welcome to the show, and let's start talking.
Thank you. I will for sure. And before we do anything, I need to take just a minute to thank you very much, Mary, for the opportunity to be on Be Unique this evening. It's a real honor, and I appreciate the time that you've taken to make this happen. And if we're going to begin anywhere, the name of my book, it's basically an autobiography, is called Incorrigible. And if you were to kind of get a definition of what that word means, it means to me fixed in a really bad way, something that's unchangeable, something that cannot be amended, is incorrigible. And the reason why I chose that name for the book has to do with experiences I had when I was very young, and I originally came from Ontario, Canada, and from a small reserve on the southern shores of Lake Huron, and the name of the reserve is Saugeen First Nation. So I'm indigenous to this country, and that's where I was born. And so to make it, you need, please interrupt me anytime, because I'll just keep going. But
you just keep right on going, because I loved reading your book, and I love listening to you tell about it. So you keep talking.
Perfect. I will for sure then. I was born on the reserve. I understand through my research that I have 12 brothers and sisters. I also understand that some of my biological siblings are 30 years my senior. So whatever age I'm at, I have brothers and sisters who are 30 years older than I am. I don't know how that happens, but again, through my research for my book,
David. We're not going to talk about how that happens.
Okay. I've got a whole story behind that one, but I won't do it on the air. But I found out through my research that my dad, my biological dad, James Patanaquat, was 86 years old when I was born. Now, I was born June 5th, 1955, so that put his birthday back in the 1980s.
No, 1880s.
My biological father was born in the mid-1880s. And how does that happen? Well, that's part of what we won't go into your show, but he fathered 12 children, right? And his wife, I understand, her name was Mina, was roughly 44 years of age when I was born. So there's some explanations here that I can't give you all right now, but that's the scenario. There's James Pataniquet, 86, mine about 44, and I'm the second from last child born to this couple. Actually, the last child born to this couple. Mom had one more child afterwards who was born about a year after I was. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, after you were born, you only had a very short life with your mother, correct?
A very short 3 years, yes. And on all accounts, everything was fine on a reserve and in our home. My mom, from what I've been told, is a very caring and nurturing woman, but had her own disabilities. She was deaf and she could not speak. So I believe we used signs to communicate with her. And I don't know actually when I first started verbalizing words, but it wasn't at that point in time though. So we were with mom. She was caring for my brother Bernard, who's about a year and a half older than me, and then myself, Alfie, and then a younger brother, Alvin. And so by the time we were three, everything changed in our lives. My mom was a victim of a hit-and-run car accident right on the main road of our reserve. I was with her, well, three of us were with her at the time, and I have recollections, I have memories of that event, although they're pretty blurred and they disappear very quickly. I remember that event taking place.
I remember reading in your book, and, you know, people talk about how a loved one was snatched from their life, but your mother was literally snatched out of your hands, wasn't she?
Yes, and I that's a good way of explaining it, because I was holding her right hand with my left when it happened, and she was obviously closest to the road, and the three of us were on the shoulder side, and the impact of that vehicle striking her just about tore my arm off. That's what it felt like when I was little.
I'm sure.
It almost took my arm out of its socket, and then I saw her flying through the air and bouncing, and everybody, before I knew it, it was just chaos. People screaming and yelling, and then I go blank.
Were there people around that saw this besides you and your brothers?
There were people who witnessed it. There were people from our community that chased this driver down and stopped him. And I guess detained him for the authorities, and he was charged with being impaired at the time, and of course criminal negligence causing death. I don't know what happened as a result of those charges or what happened to that man, but when I heard this part of my story, I had this incredible rage inside me to find him and to kill him. That's how angry I was inside for many years. I don't know how somebody could do this. But what happened after that accident, it happened very quickly, is that we were scooped from the reserve, meaning that the social service agency in Ontario, Children's Aid Society, it is called, came in and removed us immediately from the reserve. I don't know why we didn't have an option to stay with friends or older siblings or other relatives. I don't know if that was even examined. To my knowledge, we were just taken right off the reserve and became permanent guardians of the Ontario government right then and there.
This would have been in the late 50s, right?
Late 50s.
You were born in 55?
Yep.
So I know from my research into other things, during that point in time of, and this happens everywhere, the government thinks it knows what's best, and they thought that it would be best to have these poor little, you know, Native American boys put into a foster home. I guess they were assuming that you would be adopted quickly. Now, your youngest brother was adopted pretty quickly, wasn't he?
My understanding is he was adopted almost immediately, and I have not seen him to this day. then the, what happened is they kept my older brother and I together. That's one thing, one decision I was really happy about in the long run was they didn't separate us. But then they started putting us in foster homes, and no foster family could handle us. And what I mean by that is we went through 18 foster homes within 1 year of being placed in with the government.
That's more than one a month.
Exactly. So I don't know. I have snapshots, and basically just snapshots of those times and those places and some people. And it was very disturbing.
You were so young.
Exactly. Yeah. A lot of my childhood is blocked out. I kind of went into a blackout throughout most of my childhood. And this period of a year just was like that. It's just off and on pictures of very disturbing things. So what happens after a year and 18 placements is we were deemed unplaceable at that time. They could not find another foster home in the province of Ontario to take us in. So that's when they moved us to an orphanage not far from our home community, actually, I found out. And that's when we were labeled incorrigible. Yeah. And while this is happening, of course, I didn't know that, and they didn't explain it to me, nor did I could I even say that word. But I do know later through my research that we were deemed incorrigible, that there was no hope for us, that we were self-destructive, we were violent, we were acting out sexually, we were bedwetting, we were doing a number of behaviors that deemed us to be incorrigible, not being able to care for us in a proper way. So orphanage was a real treat too, and I'm saying that sarcastically. It was hell on earth. It was a hell on earth, and there's 65 roughly of us Native kids in this particular building, and it was a gong show. I watched people being victimized sexually. I too was abused sexually, physically, mentally, emotionally, psychologically, and spiritually. All that was removed from me, and we were. I felt at the time, and I remember this place. I felt at the time that I was going to die in this building, and I don't know why I felt that, or I don't know where that came from, but I had a real belief that I was not going to leave this building alive.
Wow!
So that's in 4 years, four short years, but four very. Very, very confusing years. And now I'm catching a little bug in my throat of all times.
Well, I'll tell you what. Kind of why don't you see if you can get you a sip of water? I'm going to play a little commercial. I'll give you a few seconds to get your throat clear.
That would be great. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Let me ask you a question. Do you prefer coffee or tea? This is a question we ask on our fun and informative millennial talk show called Coffee or Tea, No Phones Allowed. And why do I know? Because I'm Anna. I'm one of the co-hosts. It's a great time. It's a professionally edited weekly series that's free to watch on Be Unique's YouTube channel. That's B-U-N-E-K-E. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode and leave us a comment with your topic or guest recommendations. We love hearing from you.
Feeling better, David?
Much better. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Good. we have these little commercials that we can play anytime I want to. And they come in very handy if you get a little tickle in your throat.
I've been fighting a bit of a cold, but of all times for it to act up, and this is the worst time. But where would you like to head from
well,
here?
Well, I want to give our phone number out. If anybody who's listening now live wants to call in and talk with us, the number is 516-418-5651. That's 516-418-5651. And we are talking with David Longbok. And you were up to about the time you were 4 years old. You'd been in 18 foster homes, and then you were placed in hell on earth, basically. This was the place that had, like, the podium in the hallway, right?
That's correct. That's correct. And
what that was about?
I did later, but when I was in this building, I got into that hallway when I shouldn't have. because I was the only one there, and I swung on it for a while, and I didn't know what it was. It was huge, and it held my weight, but I couldn't see on top of it because I was so small. But around this time, and this is where my story takes a real 180, is we have a family in Toronto, a French-Canadian family in Toronto, who just lost their son in a drowning accident that fourth summer that I was alive. I didn't know these people, had never met them, but in their grief, they decided after the summer that they were going to adopt one Native child. And I don't know what, I want to say to the listener, I don't know what kind of person does this, but I do know. And this couple was an amazing couple. That they actually drove to our orphanage, came into the main hallway and walked up to that podium. And that's where they met the manager, who kept them waiting for quite a while. And they said, "We're Judy and Michael Longo, and we're here to look at Native children, maybe possibly to adopt one." And she goes, "Oh, we got lots of Native kids here." And she was a really gruff-sounding old lady. And she goes, "Well," and you know what was on top of that podium that I didn't see when I was four was a binder. And this mom, this lady went on to tell me that the manager started thumbing through this binder like it was a catalog or something. He goes, no, yeah, this one's too old. No, you don't want these two. They're incorrigible. And she goes on. And that lady said, "What did you say?" She goes, "You don't want these two. There's no hope for them." And these were her words going to a potential adoptive parent about the two of us. There's no hope for these kids. They're incorrigible. That's where the name of the book had to come from, because that's where
And you were
my life
4 years
changed.
Old, and Bernard was what,
was five? Five and a half, yeah.
Wow.
Two little guys. Yeah. So that lady stomped her foot, crossed her arms, and said, "You bring me both those boys now. I want to meet them."
And was Mrs. Longo.
That was Mrs. Longo.
What's her first name?
Judith Longo. Judith. And Michael Longo. Yeah. And
that woman was an angel on earth.
Exactly. I wish I had memory of this particular event, but I don't. But the mom described that the manager went out to get us, and she hauled us into the front foyer at arm's length, both of us by the collar, because we were kicking and trying to bite her and scratch and do all kinds of things. And she said, "This one's Alfie, this one's Bernard." And I remember asking Mom when she was still alive, I said, "What happened?" Because I was there, but I don't remember. And she said, "I fell in love with you right away." And that's what she told me later. And I still couldn't fathom that. Like, I couldn't understand how somebody could fall in love with such depraved and malnourished, and we had lice in our hair, we had sores all over our bodies, and how we could fall in love with something. But she fell in love, and she talked to her husband right away, and they agreed to adopt both of us as quickly as possible. That only took a couple of weeks back then. You know, you didn't have to wait for the government to do all what they needed to do. If you want to adopt, you sign the papers, and you adopt, taking full responsibility for us until we were 18 or until we could take care of ourselves. Mom Judith, or Judy we call her, or Mom, and Dad, mm-hmm. Michael, were two of the most amazing people in the whole wide world. And I feel myself getting a little emotional right now, because they did something for us that nobody else could. And they took a chance, and they put their hearts and their souls into it. And they ran a home based on unconditional love. And although we tested that time and time and time again, they proved that they had unconditional love for us and would do anything to help us grow and become decent human beings. Back then, though, unfortunately, because of the adoption, all the information on family, birth origin, birth community, whatever, was sealed. So we were not able to have any contact with our reserve, with our brothers and sisters, with our remaining siblings, any cousins, nephews, whatever. we're totally cut off from them completely. And life had to go on. So I grew up in this really amazing part of Toronto I lived there till I was 17 years of age. Went to kindergarten and primary school and junior high school and even into high school. And all throughout that time, there's episode after episode after episode of our acting out behavior. Things didn't get better for a long time. They got worse. And you'd think that would be kind of the opposite, having a solid home and two loving parents. My dad, when I was 8 years old, died in a plane crash.
Ooh.
When we were in that home, and we lost him in November of 63. He was flying out of Montreal to return to Toronto. And I remember hearing about this news, and I remember Mom, it was just a nightmare when I woke up and heard everybody crying. And I remember going to my mom's room, Mom and Dad's room, and I saw my mom with my two sisters, who were not my, they were my adopted sisters, one older, one younger. And they were sobbing their eyes out, crying and uncontrollably. And finally, Mom was able to compose herself and told her that Dad perished in a plane crash the night before coming home. And I heard what she said. And I also heard her say, he's with God now and he wants us to be happy. I heard her say these things, but that isn't what I believed. And I shut down emotionally. I went cold inside and I went back to
my
bed.
You were eight?
I was 8 years old, yeah. I went and jumped back into my bed, which was soaking wet from wetting the bed. And I just flew myself under the covers and I could feel myself go totally cold inside, ice cold. And I said to myself three things that I didn't share with anybody for another 20 years or so. I said, I don't trust anybody else in this world, especially adults. Get them before they get you. I mean, strike out first and don't wait. And especially adults. That's what kind of steered the rest of my life.
You know, it kind of makes sense because you were so young when your mother was taken traumatically and forcefully away from you. You know, she was killed by that drunk driver or impaired driver. And it's probably one of your earliest memories of life. You know, most people don't remember things before they're 3 years old or 4 years old. And then for the next year, you were passed around from home to home and abuse to abuse.
I
just can't fathom 18 different homes in the span of a year. And then just 4 years after you thought your life was taking a turn and getting a little stabilized, the one man that you could trust in the world was also very violently taken away from you. So it makes sense from a child's perspective that you would close down and think, I'm on my own again. And I have to take care of myself.
Exactly. And it's me against the world. It's basically what I believe.
So Bernard was not a very helpful brother for a while, was he?
No, he wasn't.
He had his own issues.
And I'm laughing. He had his own issues. He was a little older, and I know he remembered a lot more. And he remembers a lot of his experiences. And he was a lot more violent than I was. I was definitely full of anger and rage, but he was 10 times what I was. He hurt everybody that was around him any chance he got. And we haven't even started talking about when we started taking drugs or alcohol. But he would beat me almost unconscious regularly. He broke my thumb in grade 2. He broke my nose when I was a little older. I had to almost tear him off Mom a few times. And of course, he turned his rage on me. So it was a and it wasn't just, you know, I hate to say it was all Bernard, because Bernard had his own thing going. But he was lovable, too. There were times he was just so humorous and so funny and and wandered around, and there were other times he was just a raging lunatic and scared everybody around him. My brother went off on his own after grade six. We didn't see much of him for many years after that. But I know Dad's airplane accident really affected him too, but because he was there with me. We went through the same things. And I don't know how much he loved Dad. I know I did, but I'm sure he did too. So Bernard is off and running and full of anger, and acting out and so on and so forth, and experimenting with alcohol and drugs, which I started at age 12. And so he had already been a year or so into this whole thing, and introduced me to a beer, and introduced me to smoking, introduced me to pot and hashish and all kinds of other smokables, and then from there it just went down a list of self-destructive drugs that we took, ended up taking for at least until I was 17. So for about 5 years there, I was unreachable, because the only thing that I really cared for during that time, there's two things. One was to be as out of it as I possibly could get, because my addiction ran amok right from the first time I drank. I blacked out and I did some really stupid things right from the very first experience. I should have known then that it was going to cause a lot of problems, but I wasn't ready to stop.
Well, you were 12.
The other thing that...
And
I was 12.
By blacking out, you feel nothing. And if you feel nothing, then nothing can hurt you.
That's right. And plus, I'm in charge, right?
Exactly.
Plus, I run the show because I'm the one that can do this to myself. And so part of my story tries to really impact on people just how quickly addictions can happen. And I know there's many theories around this. I've studied them and I've taught them, but in my case, addiction set in overnight, and it was went from a experimental to harmful use overnight. And it was like that. It was like that with anything I touched. So the only other thing that made any sense to me during my teen years was the kids in our neighborhood. And this is going to sound really weird, but I love the kids in our neighborhood, and I spent so much time on the street playing hockey, down at the park playing football. Sometimes a group of us would go to the Toronto Island, and I'd be the one supervising them. And their parents loved me. They thought I was incredible. And their parents would invite me into their homes on our street to say goodnight to David or say goodnight to Crocky and his brother Ian. And there's just so many of them that it was an incredible feeling to have these kids look at you, look up to you, and think you're the bee's knees. And and I really cherish that, but I wouldn't let them see my other side. So I would tuck them in sometimes at night, and then I'd go out and self-destruct, come home and play with them all day, go out and self-destruct. So that behavior of trying
to
play
a good
guy.
Because, a lot of therapists and counselors say, if your child is not playing with other children, or if your child is not outgoing or isn't involved in sports, then, he's a candidate for alcoholism or drug addiction. But you were both. It was like you had two sides to you.
Exactly.
So you were busy with it. You stayed outdoors all day long, and you did all these kid things. And you were looked up to in the neighborhood, but yet as soon as you were by yourself, that's when you turned into self-destruction.
Exactly. I couldn't be alone. And part of my issue was that I loved being with the kids 8, 9, 12 hours in a day, for example, because I wasn't alone. And I was good to them. I treated them honestly and respectfully, and I taught them things, and they gave me unconditional love back.
Do you think that is because of that room you were in?
Yes.
Because you were alone for a long time.
A long
time. And isolated.
And, exactly. And being alone to me was death. And I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, I could not for any length of period of time be by myself, whether it's even in my own home. I had to be doing something or I had to be with somebody or close to somebody or go out and find something because I was too petrified to be by myself. Even at, you know, in my teen years, I couldn't be alone. So that's the only other thing that made any sense in my life during the teen years was those beautiful children. And I was also on a destructive path that no one was going to be able to stop except for me. And needless to say, make a longer story even shorter, I moved out here in 1976 after spending 3 years in Ontario at the age of 17. I was offered a job working with children in a group home because someone somewhere, when I think it was my neighbor just down the street, recommended me to this agency. And they followed up and they invited me out. And one of the children on the street was actually put into one of their homes. And I went to that mom. And I said, "Where's David?" And she said, he's in a home up in Barrie, Ontario. And I said, Why? Can I see him? I miss him. I love him. And she goes, "Of course you can see him." Well, so I went to this group home, and for the first time I saw this young boy, this young friend of mine from our street, in a group home setting, being cared for by professional care workers, child care mm-hmm. workers, in a home setting. And I thought, well, this is fantastic. This is amazing. I never knew these places existed. Well, in that same week, the manager of that particular organization came to my home and offered me a job. And I was only 17. Yeah, I was only 17 because I was just finishing up some college stuff that I was trying to get through. And he came to my home and said there he would love to have me come to one of their homes up in Haliburton, Ontario. And I said, "Holy moly, you meant to work with your kids?" And he goes, "Yeah." I said, "You're going to pay me?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "No way." I said, "You don't pay people to work with people, do you?" And he goes, "Yeah, in this field we do. It's called child care work. And we think you're ready. We think you can do it." And so on the long weekend of May 1973, I reported to my first job. And I started my first job on the long weekend when I thought everybody else was off. And I was introduced to a home and some staff and some children, which I just fit right in with. Like, I didn't have any schooling, any training in this area. I just was able to blend right in with the kids and the routines and everything else. And I could reach out to them, and I could help them, and I could play with them, and I could go outside in the farm with them. I could look at animals. I could play some hockey. We could do anything because I was full of energy. And I'd love to be around kids with that. And so I spent 3 years doing that until I realized I was being paid about 72 cents an hour. And I was working 16 hours a day, and it was just burning me right out. So I moved out to Alberta in 1976 with no job, with about $500 in my pocket, and no contacts, no reason to be in Alberta, let alone Edmonton. And just on a whim, I said, "I'm going to check it out." And I checked it out. And within 2 weeks, the Alberta government hired me as an adolescent child therapist in one of their residential treatment settings in Edmonton.
Oh, that's amazing.
And it is. Like, and I'm sitting here going, "What is going on? Like, this is phenomenal. Like, I have something to offer and professionally, but I can't seem to get this monkey off my back, and it's drinking and taking drugs. I seem to be able to put my foot forward, but I always take a few steps back." And I hit bottom in 1978, and that's when I left my job, left my girlfriend, left my home. I owned a condominium in Edmonton, left that, and I went right downtown and lived on the streets for about 11 days. And for those 11 days, I drank and I snorted and I ate drugs and I popped pills and I ate and I drank and I took drugs intravenously. I smoked drugs. And that's all I did for 11 days straight.
I just kept looking for more and more ways to escape, I guess.
Exactly. I'd reached a place where I could not find that. And the escape. It wasn't an escape anymore. It was a triumph. And I ended up going to Edmonton. It was ADAC back then, ADAC Detox Center, when I was 23. And I found out there that I fit in the category of being an alcoholic and a drug addict, things I'd never heard of until then. But it suited me perfectly because I matched the description of everything they talked about. That was me. Yes, I blacked out. Yes, I was angry. Yes, I was fired. Yes, I missed work. Yes, I did all these things that people that have drug and alcohol problems do. And the light went on. And boy, when it went on, it went on. I went, holy moly, that's the problem here. It's not really me. It's what I'm doing to me. And so I completed a program down there. And then, not many people do this, but I enrolled in a psychiatric day program right after that. And for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, for almost 7 months, I was in therapy. And I did some amazing work in therapy. And I would recommend this to anybody who's trying to come clean and sober. Most of us have background trauma. And if we don't address that trauma when we're sober, we're going to go back out. So that's what I did for 7 months. And then you'd never believe what I did to celebrate at the end of the 7 months. I went and got drunk with some friends of mine from the hospital.
Oh, no.
After all that hard work, after all the pain I'd gone through and all the work I'd done on myself, I knowingly went back into a world of total oblivion, thinking that I was all right now, that I could handle this. But it didn't happen that way. Within 5 years, I'm 28 years old, I'm almost dead. And I was so lucky, grateful to wake up that last morning. It was December 15th, 1983, a Friday morning, and I woke up, and it hit me like a ton of bricks that I tried to hang myself the night before. And that if I didn't stop drinking and taking drugs, I was going to die. It's that simple. I'm this close. I can't get any closer. So I hung my hat up again, and when I decide to do something, I guess I'm the kind of person, not that whole resiliency thing. It's always been there, and it's kicking in, and it says, you know what to do, do it. You know what you have to do, now go and do it. I said, I know what I have to do, and I'm going to go do it. And if there's one thing I'm not going to do, I'm not going to touch a drop of alcohol or any drug today. And I went to AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and dove into that whole fellowship, and it's been 36 years. And I'm sitting here age 64 going, what the heck has happened here? Like, I've had an incredible life, you know. Something got me through this, and it's only getting better. Like I could never fathom my life being the way it is now. I always wanted it. I wanted to be free of pain. I wanted to be free of fear. I didn't want to be anxious all the time. I didn't want to be scared all the time. I didn't want to be violent anymore. I didn't want any of those things. And damn it, I don't want them to the point where I'm going to do everything I can to get them out of my life. So through therapy again and through the fellowship of AA and NA and CMA and a bunch of other A's and all this work, I've been to over 6,000 meetings, self-help meetings.
Holy moly, that's a lot of meetings.
That's a lot of meetings. I've been to therapists. I've been hypnotized by psychologists. I've been put on antidepressant medication, which really, really helped. I have gone back to my culture. I have been in the sweat lodge. I have been given the name Thunder Voice by a Cree elder out here in Alberta as a way of recognizing my work and my journey and my ability to share with other people about my journey.
I'll be honest with you, David. When you told me in an email that Thunder Voice was your name, I thought, man, this guy's going to come here. He's going to sound like Barry White, because I just imagined that was what the thunder meant. But I like that. It's a subtle meaning. I like that.
Great. And I love Barry White. I don't mind saying that. He's a favorite of mine. long time ago. Don't tell anybody, though, okay?
I won't say a word.
Yeah, I still got his hits downstairs on CD. Like, he did something for me, that man. But anyways, I loved all kinds of music. But that's something I never actually touched on. My dad, Michael, was a guitarist. And he would sing songs to us. Yeah, he would sing songs to us in the living room of our home. And some of the most fantastic memories I have of him was being on the floor, cross-legged, looking up at Dad, watching him strum his guitar, watching him listen to him sing, and the face, the expressions he had on his face. And he just shined. His music just shined. And it touched me really, really deeply. And I don't often touch on that, but I started teaching myself about the time I started taking drugs and alcohol, the guitar. And I am now a fairly accomplished musician. I play guitar, drums, bass guitar, and a little bit of keyboard. And it's all because of what that spark that he left in me. And I was able to pick it up again and brush it off and grieve with my dad through my music and find a different way of helping music help me. And it's a love of my life. Music is one of my passions. But
you wrote a song for your dad, didn't you?
I did write a song for Dad, and I've written a song for Dad. I've written a song about Mom. I've written a song about Alfie, who was me. That's what they called me when I was a little boy.
Mm-hmm.
And it is called Alfie's Song. Yeah, I have a song for Alfie. I have a song for children, for young people that are having trouble in relationships. It was co-written by two teenage boys that I counseled while I was a drug counselor. We wrote it together. I have about a dozen original tunes that I've just kept kind of shelved away, and I pull them out every once in a while. I have a song about breaking the cycle of family violence. So I've just a number of things. I've taken music everywhere I've gone, and it's been part of my lecture format to fill a room with people, fill a room with thoughts and experiences, fill a room with hope, fill a room with singing, and I get everybody involved in what I do. And I'm much better live than I am on the phone, but it's something that I love to do, is to entertain and help people entertain and help people get through this thing called life, because it can be pretty, pretty obscure sometimes, and some people don't know where they're going or how to get there. So I'm still trying to help people do that through my work and through my story.
I love how you know, toward the end of your book, you've got all these songs and the lyrics back there, and it says a lot about you, and also that the letter that your mom wrote to the magazine. I hope everybody listening will go out and buy a copy of Incorrigible. And probably the best way to do that is to just Google David Langedoc, and that is spelled Langedoc. But I'm sure if they Google David and Incorrigible, or go to Be Unique. I will have all that information on. I think I'm going to have to make a blog post about this. I really do. Because I'm so enjoying your company. But just thinking about these songs, you've got All You Need Is Love by John Lennon
and
Paul McCartney. And How Can You Mend a Broken Heart by the Bee Gees, which is one of my all-time favorites. Just so much. You know, you got a Cat Stevens song in here I'd forgotten about. I'm scrolling through it trying to refresh my memory.
Yeah, Father and Son, it's called.
Yes.
Yeah.
The songs in the back of the book are worth everything. I mean, they are worth the cost of the book, I believe.
Thank you.
These are impressive songs. And, of course, you know, we were talking before the show about my first marriage. And at the very last of your book, you've got the Serenity Prayer. That got me through the worst of my marriage. And I didn't even know that was something used in Alcoholics Anonymous and all the other AAAs that are out there. And it's basically just asking God to give you the serenity or the peace of mind to accept things you can't change, because there are things you can't change. There's no need to worry about the, you know, if someone has died, you can't fix it. If the rain is falling on your wedding day, or, you know, raining on your parade, so to speak, you can't do anything about it but carry an umbrella. But you also need to have the courage to change the things you can change, which in your case you did. You could change yourself from being an addict and an alcoholic and an angry person. And you took the steps necessary to do that. But the one that always got me was the wisdom to know the difference. And I think so many people think they can change things and they can't. And so they get caught up in that. And probably that was part of what may have led to your situation. If I just drink one more bottle, or if I just take one more pill or smoke one more joint, my life will change. Things will happen. Well, the only thing that changed for you, I think, was you passed out. And how many times were you hospitalized?
Oh, from the time I started to the time I ended, I'd say about 24 times at least. Yeah, and being hospitalized to me means having an accident, hurting myself, to blacking out, and almost overdosing. So it involves a whole lot of different things. I had to go to the hospital when I was 14 because I tried to break into a home in our neighborhood by punching my fist through an 8x4 plate glass window. You can't do that, you know, in the normal state, you know, you can't do that. Well, I tried and I almost lost my thumb as a result of that. And so when I say hospital, there's lots of things that happened during that time that I needed hospital attention for. There are times I didn't know what had happened or why I was in the hospital. So there's just so many, 24.
You just woke up and there you were.
Exactly. Yeah. And never forget that long walk home from the hospital, because they said they'd give me the cab ride home, or they'd ask me if I had a parent to call them. They said I did, but I'm not going to bother them at 4:00 in the morning. Thank you very much. I can walk. And I always remember that long walk back from downtown Toronto to our home at 5 or 6 in the morning, going, you know, what's happening here? What's wrong with me? You know, I feel like I'm crazy. All I want to do right now is die. And those feelings are no longer with me. I want to live.
That's amazing.
I want to be the best. I want to be the best person I can be every day. And I won't settle for less. And if I make a mistake, I clear it up very quickly. And I move on. And that's
And
what
you don't
I
beat yourself up over a mistake.
No. Done that, been there, done that. And I don't do that anymore. I choose not. Yeah. No,
so David,
I'm going to make it honest.
Why did you write this book? Why did you write Incorrigible?
I had a few reasons why. Part of my therapy and all the work I'd done over the years, and this is what I want the reader to understand, and I'm sure some people who attempt recovery understand this, that for a while it may be good, but then we have to stop and look at ourselves. For a while, things might feel like they're changing, but then the roof falls in or something. And what happens is we do what we're so easy to be doing, and that's to go back to using and to numb that pain or to find out another way to do this. So I purposely sat down and said, I am going to say everything I need to say about me and what I remember in the best way that I possibly can that might be useful to somebody else. And I don't know how it's going to look. I don't know what it's going to look like. There's no rhyme or reason to how I'm going to do this. I'm just going to sit down and write. And that's what started the whole process. It took me about 3 years to get this thing done. I published it in 2015, and I was still finding stuff out about my family and my Ontario families that I didn't know up until that time. That's when I found out Dad was 86 years old. I didn't know that till then. So I got it in the book of the last week. But I said, I want to purge a bit here. I want people to see what it's really like for some of us. And I want people to know that there's an option. There are options. For me, there is only one option. And that was to change myself. That was to stop my self-abuse, to heal, get myself healed. And that's the only option I have. There are no other ways. And there's many ways I can do that, though. And that's the neat thing about this thing, is there's so many ways I can heal. I can cry, I can laugh, I can talk, I can sing, I can pray, I can go for a run. There's just so many ways. I can get in the sweat lodge, I can go to the church down the street. There's so many ways that I can make myself feel stronger about who I am and what I'm trying to do in this world. And it's not limited just to a handful of things. There's so many things I can do. So I could be very busy just getting better all the time, right? Since that time, and I'll just touch on this really quickly. You'd mentioned your marriage, and I want to mention that I was married twice before, and neither one of them worked out. One, I was in the throes of my addictions. Two, I was in the throes of my recovery, which wasn't very fun at the beginning either. But we stayed together for 21 years and helped raise two boys that are incredible boys to this day. And I'm working on marriage number three, and this is my last one, because I found a lady that totally understands me and gets it. She is in recovery too, and she is doing the same kind of work that I am doing. We don't nag each other about this work either, because it's very personal. I need to do something. I need to do it. If she needs to go somewhere, she goes and does it. We know it's not a comparison thing. It's not a who's doing better. We don't never challenge each other on our sobriety and our clean time. We just know we're doing it.
I think that's something people don't understand. This is a solitary journey. Recovery is not something you can do necessarily. I mean, it's nice to have someone else who understands you, who's going through it too.
Yeah.
But it's not a couple activity.
No.
It's a personal solo activity. And I mean, it's fine if you, just like anyone's journey in life, sometimes you can walk down the path with someone at your side on the same path, but at some point they veer off. They have to go their own way. And it's that way with recovery too.
Yeah. Okay. It is. And you're so right about that, because I bring it back in my program or my daily living. Now I bring it back to why I'm here. And it was a solo journey right at the beginning. I did this for me. I didn't do it for my family. I didn't do it for my brothers and sisters. I didn't do it for anybody. I did this for me. And I keep bringing it back to that every decision I've made since letting go of alcohol and drugs and entering help and care and recovery, I've done with that idea in my mind at the foremost, is that I cannot drink. I cannot use anything. The only option I have right now is to continue getting better. That's all I have. I can never go back, and I never will. 36 years is a long time, but I plan to keep going until I die, and I'm going to die sober. I'm going to die clean, and I'm going to leave this world hopefully a little bit better when that happens.
Bravo.
My wife and I were together since 2005, and I tell you, it's amazing to be with somebody that understands. So you're right about that. But we've done our own solo stuff, and we've done some stuff together in recovery. We've done lectures and we've been guest speakers and stuff together as a couple, because some people can't see that. They don't see that part of it, eh? It's easy for one person to come in recovery, but it doesn't mean the partner has to follow them. But then there's often a wedge drawn in between them, and it's unfortunate, but I've seen this happen time and time again, where they go separate ways. And there's no reason to blame that, buddy. That's just the way it goes. But Marcy and I are totally in love with each other and have been since 2005 when we finally met. And I tell you, she does her own thing. I do my own thing, and we do things together. But
and that's, I think, what's so important. You have to have individual lives that intersect from time to time.
Exactly. Yeah, on common ground, I call it. Yeah, on the same page.
Yes.
Yeah. And so what we decided to do is we decided to be trained for foster parents because we had this ideal that wow, wouldn't it be great if we did this training and filled our home with lovely little kids and took care of them, which I love to do, and then maybe we could be together doing this day in and day out because, you know, you're not poor if you're running a home full of kids. You make ends meet, and you don't get rich doing it, but you make ends meet. And so that was our plan, was to get training, fill a home, and eventually I'd leave my full-time job, and we'd be together happily ever after. And that happened within a month after us completing our training. Our house was full. I was working full-time. I realized I had to leave work because it was really a handful for Marcy to be here with five kids, and at the one time six kids, by herself.
Yeah.
And from different, it's like fostering is an amazing job. Like, I gotta tell you, I left work, my full-time position, came home, and we've had like almost 20 different kids in our home. And
wow.
Since that time, we've adopted two boys, one who's been with us for 7 years now since birth, and the other one who's been with us for 6 years since birth. He came to us right from the hospital.
Lucky boys.
Yes, and lucky us too. They're amazing boys. I wish you could meet them sometime. And recently, we've had a small infant who is a sibling to the younger boy we adopted, half sibling to me. Yeah, and she came to us right from the hospital. She had to spend 2 months in the hospital because of some medical issues regarding her mom's using and her mom's behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
So we brought her home to us, and she's been with us. Been with us since July of last year, and we're looking at either applying for private guardianship or adopting her too. And I think that'll be the end of the adoptions for me because I'm getting up there in years.
Famous last words.
Exactly.
I will check in with you in a few years, and we'll see where you stand on that.
For sure. Well, by that time, we'll be back in Ontario. We plan to go back in the next couple of years and to settle down in there and do a little retiring thing back there. So I hope we can stay in touch over the time because I certainly appreciate the time with you. And I feel like I talked to you about anything, and I really appreciate the conversation.
I've enjoyed this a lot. And I have a favor to ask.
Please.
We have a few minutes left before the show ends, but would you sing us to the end of our show? Have you got your
sing
guitar?
Sing us to the end of the show?
Yeah.
I don't have it upstairs, it's downstairs, but I can do a vocal version of, for example, For All Our Children. And
perfect.
That's the one that specifically talks about breaking the cycle of violence.
That would be perfect. I just want to tell all of our listeners that if they want to find you on social media, you're on Facebook and you're on LinkedIn.
Yep.
And David is just David. Langdok is spelled Langudoc. It looks like Langudok. But find him. And I want to say thank you so much. I definitely want to talk with you again. I will stay in touch and take it away.
Thank you very much again for having this opportunity to share on your show, Mary. And it's been a pleasure meeting you too. For All Our Children, Please. It's a song that was penned by me about 12 years ago. And it talks about breaking the cycle of violence in families. And I don't have my guitar handy, but I'm going to give you a vocal version right here.
Perfect.
Okay.
Nothing like putting you on the spot.
Yeah, I know. I wish I had my guitar. Could I run and get my guitar? Do we have time to do that?
Go get it. I'll wait for you.
Okay.
I'll talk to the people. I'll tell them a little bit about Incorrigible while you're gone. You're welcome. David wrote Incorrigible with the intent to teach others with similar experiences to never give up. He wrote it for professional communities to provide personal insight to the power of unconditional love, and so that many children who are intrinsically gifted with resiliency will produce unbelievable results when they are encouraged. Incorrigible was written to profile how quickly addictions can set in. And like David said, his set in with the first use. Incorrigible was written to illustrate that miracles do happen. And now I hear David is back. So take it away, David.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Today are full of fear. By all they see and what they hear, they learn that life is one big secret, not knowing who to trust or who will care. Here's my answer. Reach to the child within us all. For hope must first come from within. Of abuse must be broken, so healing for all our children can begin. It's time to speak into their sadness. It's time to end their misery. Let's give hope to all our children that someday, maybe someday, they'll be free. Let's give hope to all God's children, that maybe someday they'll be free. Ooh, for all our children.
Thank you, David, and good night.
Good night. Thank you very much.
I will send you a link to the show. It'll archive within 24 hours, and then you will have it.
Thank you, and we'll be in touch, okay?
All right. We certainly will. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.